Yeah, thank you very much for the introduction. So I'm very glad to have the chance here to speak in Santa Barbara, and of course I'm very glad that you're here despite of Veterans Day. The topic I'm talking about today is fracture mechanics, and I mean, nowadays we're doing fancy things. We are talking about superstring, so why we are still doing cracks, which is nothing else than mechanics. So, but I will show you that they're very interesting anyhow. The work I'm going to talk about is done by Efim Brehner and me. So he's sitting over there. And let me start with a quick overview of my talk. So I will start with a quite long introduction just to inform you about some ingredients which I need for my talk here. And it consists basically of two parts. It's an introduction to fracture mechanics. And I mean, maybe some of you were here during this mini workshop, which I think it was in August, so probably you know something about fracture mechanics. And you probably also know about this so-called Winfried instability. But anyhow, I will explain you both of this. And these are formally, these are two more or less independent fields of research. And the intention of my talk is, in some sense, to fill the gap between those two fields, to show you that they are not too different from each other and maybe stronger related to each other than it's commonly believed. And the second part of my talk is really the synthesis of these ideas, and I will explain you more carefully how this comes together. It will lead to some mechanism to describe crack growth by surface diffusion, and in particular we will study the steady state growth of a crack and some possible tip splitting instability. If we look at fracture processes, they happen everywhere in our world. I mean, just imagine some shattered windshield or whatever. But also on bigger scales, let's say in geology, we have very big formations with large cracks. For example, in earthquakes, which is very important here in California, of course. But they appear also in other systems, also here on some geological scales, where, let's say here, some drying mud, where stresses arise during this drying process, and this finally leads to some fracture process. And very similar here, this is the so-called Giant's Causeway in Ireland, but we have similar formations also in here in California, the so-called Devil's Post Pile. So here, if you look on the top of these patterns, they look very similar to these. So this occurred all during the solidification of the lava. And this led to some thermal stresses and finally to the fracture processes. But mainly today, I'm going to talk about cracks on a very much smaller scale. So I'm looking at individual cracks. For all these processes, it's very important that you have some interactions between cracks. But here, I'm talking more or less about single cracks. And I will ask some very simple questions. I mean, if we look at these patterns, they are not simple. They are already quite complicated. We have complicated paths of the crack, and many, many peculiar phenomena can happen. And very recently, I just want to mention this very briefly, but maybe Efim will give a talk on this later too. It was found out that cracks are also very important for friction processes. So for example, if you have chalk on the blackboard, and then sometimes it produces these noises which occur because we have some transitions between stick and slip motion. So we have some areas where the contact between the two solid phases is stick, and somewhere else is slip. And these slip regions, they're in some sense they're very similar to cracks. And even if I restrict to a single crack, there, I mean, these patterns can be really beautiful, but I think at the current stage, we have to say that we are not able to understand what's really going on there. So, for example, here I have three questions just to point out what we are doing. So the question is, why are cracks not always straight? What is the pattern of the shape of cracks? What is the velocity with which they propagate? And in particular, if we really look at the very small area of the crack tip, The question is, how does it look? Is it sharp? Is it not sharp? Why? And it's very difficult to answer all these questions. And also, I mean, it's in particular, if you imagine really the windshield, we know that crack is not always straight, but it can also split and produce some side branches. And the question is why all this happens. So now I start with my first part of the introduction to remind you of some basic facts of fracture processes. For simplicity, I'm always talking here about two dimensions. It's not a real restriction because, I mean, two dimensions have a big advantage because there we can use some special techniques, conformal mappings to solve elastic problems. But here I mainly use scaling arguments, which are also valid in three dimensions. But just for simplicity, I restrict myself to two dimensions. So imagine we have some piece of solid on which we exert some external stress P. We assume that this is a tensile stress here. And then obviously we have some elastic energy density inside this body, which is proportional to P square in a linear approximation. So of course energy is quadratic there. And by dimensional reasons, of course the energy density is proportional to P square divided by E, where E is the elastic modulus of the solid here. So what happens if now, by some reasons, a crack appears in the sample? Let's say this crack has an extent R. Then we have some relaxation of elastic stresses in an area which is approximately of size R square. So it means we have some decrease of elastic energy proportional to area times elastic energy density. But on the other hand, we have an increase of surface energy because we created two new surfaces, and since this is a one-dimensional object, it's proportional to the length of the crack, so surface energy behaves like alpha times R, where alpha is the surface energy density. And this was first realized by Griffith already around 80 years ago. And if you plot this quantity, the total energy against length of the crack, then we see that we first have an increase of energy, and that energy goes down, and this leads finally to the complete breaking of the solid. But in between, we have some critical values, the so-called Griffith threshold, and at this threshold, the body is in equilibrium, so we have some crack which is in unstable equilibrium, which means that if the crack becomes shorter, then it wants to shrink again, it can disappear under some circumstances, but if it's longer, then the solid really wants to break, and finally the body is completely relaxed and we have only some small amount of surface energy in the system. It is very important to look at this critical length scale because it will also appear in the so-called Griffith instability later. Of course, it's very clear, the harder we pull our body, the longer this critical threshold is and the easier it is to overcome the threshold to the breaking procedure. Okay. Yes?
So the reliable estimate of the length.
Again? I'm sorry. By order of magnitude or?
Order of magnitude.
I mean, it depends on this. You have one control parameter, this external stress here. So then it depends. So you cannot say this in general. See? What is also very important that we have some universal behavior if we go really to the vicinity of a crack tip. So here we have, in this picture, we have a crack, and now I'm looking really in this area, and this is depicted here, these three sketches. In fact, we can decompose our external stress into three so-called loading modes, load mode 1, 2, and 3. This one is, of course, the most important one for usual crack processes. This one is important for friction processes, and this one also in earthquakes, all these appear here. But at the moment, we can restrict ourselves to this mode 1 loading. But anyhow, in all three cases, we can look at the stresses, also at displacement fields, but here I'm mainly interested in stresses in the vicinity of the crack tip. And if I introduce some local coordinates, so I have some distance from the crack tip and I have some angle here, then we have some singularity of the stresses in the vicinity of this infinitely sharp crack tip. This is a square root singularity. And we also have some typical angular dependence of the stresses here by this function fij. And it's very important that this function, it's independent of the shape of the crack, of all the loading. This is a universal function. It depends only on the mode of loading. And we can decompose any kind of loading into these three types. All other information, the shape of the crack, the type of loading, everything, this is combined in the so-called stress intensity factor, which is just a scalar quantity. And by scaling, it has the behavior p times r to the 1/2. And it contains really the full information about the whole crack. And in this language, we can also express the Griffith equilibrium by using the stress intensity factor, which gives a selection of r, the Griffith threshold. So far, it was simple, but of course, everything becomes complicated if we look at experiments. I mean, it's easy to imagine that cracks cannot be infinitely fast. There must be some upper velocity. And I will comment on this later on the next slide. So we have some upper velocity limit, the so-called Rayleigh speed, which is nothing else than the sound speed at a free surface. And conventionally, one would expect that nothing extraordinary happened because, yeah, cracks can accelerate up to this velocity, but what else? But in reality, it's different. I mean, here's some experiment. We have some crack in a narrow channel. So here's this channel, some solid, and there is a crack. And if one pulls with a very low velocity, the crack is straight, going with a constant velocity, everything is fine. But then, if we pull harder and the velocity of the cracks becomes bigger, then suddenly some funny things happen. So here's some side branches, here not very many, appear, so we have some extra cracks here. And if you pull harder and harder, these side branches become more and more longer and also denser. And simultaneously, the velocity of the crack, which is quite well defined below the threshold, it suddenly starts to oscillate. And it's completely unclear what is happening here. Also, it's very astonishing that this critical velocity is still very far from this terminating velocity, this VR, this Rayleigh speed. It's usually around 30 or 40% of this terminating velocity. And if we exceed it, then we observe some tip slitting and strong velocity oscillations. So the question arises, how can we understand this?
Well, how big is the actual crack area where actually the breaking happens? And how many atomic units are there?
Yeah, this is, of course, a very important question. And I will also comment on this a bit slightly later. Of course, it depends on the material. See, if you have, let's say, silicon, and you break the solid along the crystallographic axis, then this area of breaking, this is really on an atomic scale, and you have individual breaking like a zipper. If you have softer materials, this can be different. So this can be a very large, relatively large area. So what happens if we look at this from a more theoretical point of view? I already mentioned that we have some upper velocity limit, and we can get this upper velocity limit not by taking into account the full Newtonian equation of motion. So we have an elastic force energy. This is balanced by mass density times acceleration. And this, it's very interesting that, I mean, we are talking about classical mechanics, but anyhow, this gives some terminating velocity. And in reality, there are many similarities to theory of relativity here. But just by scaling, one immediately obtains that this velocity must have this scaling behavior, E divided by rho. Rho is the mass density and square root of this expression. And it was mainly Freund who discovered how all the fields, elastic fields in the vicinity of the crack tip change if we also introduce these dynamical effects. So first of all, the structure remains unchanged. So we still have the square root singularity of stresses. We have some characteristic angular dependence, which is also a universal function. And we have the stress intensity factor. Now it's a dynamical stress intensity factor. And both these functions now also depend on this ratio V over VR in a quite complicated way, but this is not very important here. So for example, here, the dynamical stress intensity factor expressed in terms of the static stress intensity factor here, which is a measure for our applied force. It goes down if you pull harder and harder and harder, and if you really reach a terminating velocity, this Vr, then the stress intensity factor as effective driving force becomes zero, and the crack cannot accelerate further, so it cannot become faster than this Rayleigh speed. But also this function, this angular function here, becomes velocity dependent in a very complicated way. So suddenly we have some bumps here which show for certain components of this function, which show that the maximum stress is no longer in the forward direction but at some angle. And this was discovered by Joffe, who already argued that this might be some indication for a tip splitting instability, because now the main stress is not in forward direction but somewhere else. But from a real theoretical point of view, this is not very convincing, because, I mean, having some stress maximum in a certain direction, this is not a physical principle which really says that a crack must go in this direction. Everything is quite complicated here. So nobody really knows what's going on.
What's the reason for the square root?
Well, of course, I can answer very simply that this is a solution of the theory of elasticity. But you can understand it also in the following way. If you have a sharp crack, let's say a straight crack along the x-axis, half the semi-infinite crack, then you can use some conformal mapping techniques to solve the elastic problem. And in this case, it is done by taking the square root of some function, and this finally leads to the square root singularity. But it's rather complicated here.
But this square root is correct both to the
two-dimensional. Right. Yes, it's correct. I mean, yes, it's correct.
I know that it's a kind of side issue, but you're rather dismissive of the scale effect. And I'd like to say that I think there's more to it than that you say in a bond breaking theory. And lots of people, myself included, have done treatments of fracture on the left. You just take a
right.
You break a bond when you stretch it.
Right.
And various people, Michael Martyr and also others, found something like the LP effect. But specifically, what we do is we solve things equations for our legs.
Right. Yes.
Then we found that if the crack was going fast enough, we stabilized it with a viscosity. So if we go, you found if it goes fast enough, sure enough, the bonds off on the side were being stretched more than the ones straight ahead.
Right. You're perfectly right about this. And but I think these are two different kinds of description. I mean, if you really go, I will also comment on this later. If you go down to an atomic level, then you say that a bond breaks if some stress is exceeded, and then it's clear that this is a crucial point here, that here you have some higher stresses here, and this gives rise to complicated patterns here.
But which indeed we found that
actually. Right. It's absolutely correct. Here, what I'm going to talk about is, it's on a different level. I'm using macroscopic mechanics. I'm not going down to the atomic level. And then I need some equations of motion. And I cannot simply say that here this is the direction of maximum stress. This is not sufficient here.
We should discuss it later.
Right.
But even in your theory, this effect has to be there somewhere.
Yes, it's very important. It's very important. So to sum up all this a bit and to give some outlook, many people are discussing fracture mechanics, especially in the past years, so it became very interesting to physicists too, not only to engineers. And obviously, there are some things which have to be understood, because I told you that we have some square root singularity of stresses in the vicinity of a crack tip in the framework of a linear theory of elasticity, provided that the crack tip is infinitely sharp. So this cannot be. There cannot be a divergence. There must be something which cuts off this singularity. For example, there could be a finite tip radius. We could also take into account nonlinear effects. Or other things which are probably also very important, and Jim Langer, Lenz Eastgate, they are discussing this. Plastic zones, so you have some area around the crack tip, because here the stresses are very high, and then you also have some plastic flow in this area. And they are developing theories to describe the complicated mechanics in this area. Because of course, this is really, really complicated because you, in some sense, you have to match it to classical elastic theory, which is valid outside. And then you here, you have your complicated physics, you have some parameters which you have to adjust properly. And this is very complicated. I mean, there are also other effects. You are here, you have really high stresses and also high gradient of stresses. And then dislocations and defects of the solids, they are really mobile objects, and they can also influence everything. And of course, in particular, if you want to understand why cracks are not always straight, you can also discuss granular media, anisotropic crystals, and all other things to understand what's going on there here. And what you already mentioned is that you can also go down to an atomic level discussing atoms which are connected by bonds, and then you have to you need some rules to describe the motion, which is, I mean, this is very simple. You just say that you have Newton's law for each atom, but you have to say under which circumstances a bond can break and when it can reconnect and everything. But you see, this is all this fracture mechanics is very complicated, and I think we are still far from understanding all this. What I'm going to tell you today is this is an attempt of developing a minimum theory. We are just putting things together, and we don't want to introduce really new theories. We just want to understand what's happening if we really analyze what we already have. And I will come back to this point later. But just to sum up, there are two things which are very important. So first of all, we have a very good understanding of the elastic behavior in the vicinity of a crack. But the main problem here is that we don't know the equations of motion for a shape of a crack. So now I come to my second point of my introduction, the so-called Sarrow-Tiller-Grünfeld instability. And there was also some talk about this subject in August here by Philippe Barra. Maybe you know this. I will remind you about this. The Grünfeld instability is a very peculiar phenomenon because it's completely different than fracture mechanics. You have a body, and you apply some external stress to this body. It can be compressive or tensile. The only thing which is important is that at the surface of the body, the normal and the tangential stresses have to be different. This is the main requirement for this instability. And if we have a body which is under this kind of load, then it suffers from a morphological instability, which means that the body can reduce its total energy by some rearrangement of material. I mean, this is not, I mean, here one has to be very careful. Let me show it like this. I mean, you can crumple up a piece of paper doing like this. But this is not what I'm going to talk about, because this is a very simple phenomenon. And it's, of course, it's different if I pull or push my body. But this here, it's independent of the sign of the applied stresses. What happens here is that we have some, you can say it like this, where you have some melting here in some area. The material diffuses along the surface and can recrystallize at somewhere else. And this leads to a deformation of the body. And this will happen provided that the total energy of the system goes down. So what drives this process locally? We have some competition of elastic and surface energy. Surface energy always wants to keep the body straight, so it's proportional. The chemical potential here is proportional to the curvature of the surface. And on the other hand, we have an elastic influence here. Here really is this difference between normal and tangential stresses appears, and since it's squared, it does not appear on the sign of the stress. And we can introduce some simple surface diffusion process performing a stability analysis of the straight surface. So we have some perturbation of the surface which can increase or decrease in time. And then we can calculate the spectrum of this process. So let's see what's happening here. This D is the diffusion coefficient. This is some atomic volume, which is not very important here. This K square appears due to the surface diffusion process, because we say that the normal velocity of this profile is proportional to the Laplacian of the chemical potential. Here we have the surface energy contribution, which always wants to flatten the surface. And on the other hand, we have some elastic effect, which appears here in a complicated way, and always wants to amplify the instability. Nu is the Poisson ratio. So here we have, I'm doing only isotropic theory, so there are only two elastic coefficients, as E elastic modulus and Poisson ratio. So if you look at the spectrum of this process, then we see that short waves mode are stable, they're hampered by surface energy, but long wave modes can be unstable and they can develop in time. What is important here, that the relevant length scale which appears here for this Greenfield instability is again same as for the Griffiths process. So this is Griffiths length which appears here and already gives some indications that Greenfield instability and Griffith threshold might be related processes. We don't observe this process usually in our day-to-day life because it's very slow. Surface diffusion along the surface at normal temperatures is really slow. And I mean, basically all our objects in our world should suffer from this instability because just by from the gravitational force, we all walls have different normal and tangential stresses, but we never observe this instability because usually it's slow. But I will show you that there's no reason that it's always slow, and it might be very important for fracture processes. Surprisingly enough, if we go to the later stage of this process, so we have some initial instability, some small perturbation, it develops in time, and then it turns out that very deep grooves can form, always reducing the total energy of the system. And these grooves grow faster and faster and faster. The tip radius of these grooves become smaller and smaller. And finally, after a finite time, we have some collapse of the system. Everything breaks down. The velocity reached infinity. The tip radius is zero. So what's going on there? So people were stuck on this problem for a very long time. So this was basically my introduction, and now I want to go into this combination of these two processes, Greenfield instability and Griffith threshold crack propagation. Already some years ago, we had the following idea that if we have a crack which is initially straight between two points, minus L and plus L on one axis, and we have force which is exerted perpendicular to this axis, then by solving the elastic problem, one sees that along this straight axis, normal stresses are zero by boundary conditions, but the tangential stresses are of the same order of magnitude as the external force. So again, here it happens as well that we have some difference between normal and tangential stresses, and this should cause Greenfield instability also in these processes here. And the very new idea here is that we introduce some new degree of freedom. So, I mean, conventionally, a crack is always understood as, yeah, let's say, a trace which is left behind if the tip moves and advances. But here, we allow also the already existing crack surfaces can still deform. And the argument to understand all this is very simple. We have some characteristic unstable wavelength, which is of the order of this Greenfield length, which is again the Griffith threshold. And on the other hand, we have some quantization length because this unstable length has to fit into this interval from minus L to L. So if the crack lengths exceed this critical length, then it should be possible that this instability occurs, and we evaluated all this numerically and saw that the instability can occur if it exceeds this critical value, which is 5.18 times the Griffith threshold. So in principle, there should be also this kind of instability, but of course, usually one cannot observe it because first of all, it's very slow, and second, if we are in this regime, we already exceeded the Griffith threshold, which means that the crack wants to advance, and this is much faster than all diffusion processes, and we can never really observe this process, and also it's very slow and it cannot influence the behavior of the tip. But this gave already some insights, and we saw some peculiar behaviors in the vicinity of the crack, that there were some certain divergences of the shape, and we studied all this more carefully. So now comes the main idea that we really wanted to know what happens if we have some Grignard instability directly at the tip of the crack. And this, we came up with the following idea, that we have some shape of the crack. Let's say it looks like this. So this is the crack and this is the tip of the crack. It looks very funny here. But what is important that we have some finite radius. The crack wants to advance with a certain velocity v. And what we are going to do is that we say we have some distribution of stresses. These stresses lead to some chemical potential along the surface of the crack. And the chemical potential causes some flux along the surface, the material flux. So you can say that this is kind of melting process and recrystallization somewhere else. This is all what we put in. We have some linear theory of elasticity, which we use to solve the elastic problems. We say that we have some surface diffusion process along the surface using the well-known expressions for the chemical potential and the laws of diffusion, and that's it. So we have a closed theory for the whole body, which is valid everywhere, which consists only of these two ingredients. And of course, this is very important, very difficult to solve, because to have a self-consistent solution of this problem, we have to find the shape of the crack self-consistently. We don't know it in advance, so it's very complicated from a numerical point of view, and we're still fighting with this problem. But basically, there are two very important questions. First of all, whether by this process, stationary growth with a fixed velocity v is possible. So we really remove some material here, it wanders around the surface and recrystallizes here again. And by this, the whole crack can move without changing its shape. And the question is whether this is really possible. And of course, the main question is, can this process be fast? Because, surface diffusion is slow, but can this process be fast? And I will tell you that the answer to this question is yes. But then we have the question arises really how the shape of the crack looks like, because it's a complicated free boundary problem. And what is very important, especially from this point of view of this Grignard instability, how this length scale R is selected. We saw for the Grignard instability that there is obviously some problem with this length scale, because it always wanted to become smaller and smaller and smaller. And is it possible that this length scale is selected somehow? Or does the system break down after a while? And on top of this, all this, we can ask whether this propagation of the crack can become unstable, so we can get some tip splitting, which is indicated here by the dotted lines. I want to address to this second question first, because we can easily understand what's the logic behind all this. And of course, it was the instability which attracted our interest. So we already saw that a crack can become unstable in the long wave limit along this long branch of the crack. But we are asking whether it's possible also to have some instability in the tip region. And just to analyze this, we looked at a very specific example, an elliptical crack, to analyze all this, because this is simple, because one knows the analytical solution of all elastic problems here. And if we go to the limit that one of the semi-axes is much bigger than the other one, then this looks very close to a normal crack. So we saw that this long wave instability, this blue one, can occur if the length of the crack becomes of the order of the Griffith length of the crack. And the reason for this is that we have this Grignard length here, which is of the order of this length, and it has to fit into this quantization interval length of the crack. What happens if we do the same procedure in the vicinity of the crack? So we analyze the stresses, that especially the tangential stresses here in the tip region, and we see that they behave in this way, that this ratio of A over B with a semi-axis A and B. And of course, this expression is divergent if we go into the limit that B goes to zero. This is clear because we know that all stresses diverge in the square root singularity if we have an infinitely sharp tip. So what is also, now we can do the same analysis. So the Grignard length which is relevant for an instability in this region, is also, it has the same structure, E times alpha, elastic modulus times energy, surface energy density, divided by characteristic stresses square. And here also we have to look for the proper quantization length, and here it's nothing else than the radius of curvature in this region, so it behaves like this. And if they become comparable, we can expect some instability. And in fact, if we evaluate these two expressions here, we observe that the instability can be expected if the length of the crack is again of the order of the Griffith length. This is important. This is a very important result, because here this length B has completely dropped out of all our equations. Only the macroscopic lengths are important here. And this is also a very reasonable length, because we know that cracks can become unstable if they have reasonable lengths, which means that they are of the order of the Griffith lengths. So this gave us a very strong indication for the occurrence of this instability. But the more difficult part is not the stability analysis, but really to understand how a stationary growth of a crack is possible by surface diffusion. Because we already saw that the deep grooves of the Greenfield instability, which look very similar to cracks, that they collapse somehow because there is no selection of some tip radius and the velocity always goes up. And now I can give you an explanation for this behavior. It's very simple. If we really use some knowledge of fracture mechanics, which I presented to you earlier. So we know that we have some So I'm looking at a particular shape of the crack, and I compare it to the same shape of crack, which is increased by some factor A. This is just to show that we have some scaling behavior here. We know that the stresses diverge in a square root singularity in the vicinity of the crack tip. So the characteristic stresses on the surface must behave like this. Obviously, the curvature of the crack is proportional to r to the minus 1. This is by definition. And the chemical potential which drives the surface diffusion process, it consisted of two parts, sigma square and this curvature contribution. And it's very important that here in this expression, both ingredients, elastic and surface contributions, scale in the same way, like r to the minus 1. This means that we will see that there is no selection. If they scale in a different way, then there would be some selection process for this length scale. But since they do it in the same way, there is no selection. This can be seen very easily here. If we study the normal velocity of each interface point, the normal velocity is proportional to the Laplacian of the chemical potential. So by scaling, it must behave like this r to the minus 3. Or in other words, if we really go introduce the scaling factor here, if we have a solution for steady state growth for a certain tip radius r, then we can blow up everything by this factor a. The velocity simply goes down by this factor a to the minus 3, but this is still a solution. Or in other words, having one solution, we immediately have a whole family of solutions. But this is a very simple argument, and it's not just to illustrate what's going on. One can explain it more carefully, but I will skip this here. Maybe I can do this later. The basic idea here is, since both contributions to the chemical potential scale in the same way, there is no selection of the tip radius. And in fact, it's even more complicated. It's not that we have a family of solutions. It's really, one can show this, there is no solution of this problem, and therefore there is no steady state growth for this conventional description, and therefore there must be this breakdown of the theory in the Greenfield instability. So,
the rods are using linear lengths.
Yes.
And the stresses, in fact, get quite large.
Yes.
Are you sure the nonlinear effects won't give you the cutoff if you're pressing them?
This is conceivable, sure. But,
and of course, there's always an atomic cutoff, but that's
linear. Right.
I would think that a nonlinear elasticity would set in much earlier. It always sets in. Before you had a Griffith length scale,
Again?
You had a Griffith length scale that came in the instability curve. Why does that drop out in this argument?
We'll come back to this. I mean, this Grundfried instability will appear later again. We will have a secondary instability of propagating shape, like this here. But here, I really want to study the steady state without instability. So I'm just looking for a stationary growth of a crack, and I'm not. So I don't ask whether the solution is stable or unstable. I'm simply asking whether it exists or not. And the answer is here that, using this conventional description, it cannot exist.
The length scale came from balancing two pieces in the mechanical potential, it wasn't a dynamic length scale.
This length scale is precisely steep radius itself, and that is why there is no selection. Not that it's separate. If it would be separate length scale, of course it would do the job. But this is precisely the statement that Grundfried length scale is precisely steep radius.
I can give a more detailed explanation of this probably later, but I want to skip it here because I don't want to go too far into the technical details. The question is, how can we overcome this cusp singularity? Now we understood where it comes from. We have the scaling behavior of stresses in the vicinity of the tip, and this is the reason why we don't have a selection, provided that we don't introduce nonlinear effects. And the answer is, in principle, it looks very simple. I mean, we see that everything becomes very fast, and we must have some cutoff for velocities. But in fact, it's a very complicated mechanism. But what we're doing is in principle very simple. We saw that in all our processes, we have only this combination of v times r cube really appears in our equations, and we can, by making the tip radius bigger, this we can always compensate by making the propagation velocity smaller, and we still have a solution. But if we really introduce also dynamical effects, which means inertial effects, then we had this other behavior of stresses in the tip region, where we also have another dependence of velocity appears also in another combination, not also in this v times r cube, but also in this ratio v over vr. And now it appears in two different ways. So if we go to our equations of motion, now I cannot simply rescale this tip radius, recalculate v, because then this ratio has changed, and then all stresses have changed, and now we have a selection procedure for all processes here. And this means more technically that we now have two independent parameters in the problem, this v over vr and this vr cube. And this leads to the selection of the tip radius, and this allows for the steady state grows with the constant velocity of the crack. But still, this is very simple, very difficult to solve, because we have to solve the elastic problem on an a priori unknown crack shape, find all velocities, then we can let the crack shape advance. And this is very complicated. I mean, we have to find everything self-consistently. And since elasticity enters into all equations in a complicated non-local way, it's hard to solve this. And first, just to understand what's going on and also to demonstrate important things, we introduced some local models where we skip all non-local effects. Of course, this also leads to some problems, but I think we understand this, and I will comment on this later. So we just said we don't solve the elastic problem here. We make a simpler case. This is not correct. It does not completely describe nature, but it gives at least a chance to describe steady state growth with a constant velocity. We say that we model these tangential stresses and do not solve the elastic problem using some expression which is very similar to what we really obtain if we solve the problem. So we have the square root singularity. We have effectively some dynamical stress intensity factors, which is some combination of the static stress intensity factor times some velocity dependent function. It has the right behavior that it goes to zero as we approach the Rayleigh speed. We have some angular dependence of all stresses. But it's not very important to have all the details here correct. So the model is very robust, so we can exchange it to other models and qualitatively always get the same behavior. The main simplification here is that we don't have to deal with complicated integral equations, but we can reduce the whole problem to a differential equation for the shape, which is a third order differential equation. And of course, this is simple to solve. I can put it on again.
Yeah, sure.
So we can look at this more carefully. Let's say that we have that velocity is zero. Then we have some stress distribution function. This is this angular function here, which has a maximum in forward direction here. Due to this cosine, this one disappears. If we approach really Rayleigh speed, then this disappears, and we have something which is more pronounced in other directions. So this is exactly this Yoffe transition.
But where does this come from? I mean,
just a model.
It's just a model.
Okay, so
just a minute. Just a minute.
Okay.
That's a model for you.
Yes, but of course you cannot go really up to the Rayleigh speed. If you're somewhere in between, then this angle appears at some reasonable values. So what are the results if you do all surface diffusion on top of this? First of all, this is how a crack shape looks like in such a description. This looks a bit nasty in the first view, but one always has to consider that we always describe everything in elasticity and normal elasticity in the so-called reference shape. So this is how the crack shape would look like in the vicinity of the tip if we release all external loading. So if we apply also some loading, then we have some extra opening of the crack here, and it looks more like a parabola. But we have some finite radius here, and this is the shape of a crack, how it would look like if this model described everything correctly. So we have some propagation velocity of the crack advances with this velocity, keeping its shape fixed. We have some tip radius here. And yeah, we can calculate all interesting quantities. We can calculate tip radius and propagation velocity. We use some dimensionless driving force here, which is basically the stress intensity factor squared. All this is just to have everything dimensionless here. The Griffiths in this, if I do it like this, then the Griffiths point where the crack is exactly at equilibrium and does not want to proceed, the Griffiths point is this delta equal 1. And then we see the following behavior. First, the harder we pull first, the velocity, the higher the velocity becomes. Then here in this model, but this is specific to this choice of model, it's slightly different in other models, the velocity can go down again in a steady state case. But this is not very, very important here. The only important thing is that we have some saturation of the velocity here. And especially if you look at the scale of the velocity, the scale of the velocity is the Rayleigh speed, which is sound speed. So though we have surface diffusion, which lets the crack advance, the speed of the crack is the sound speed here, or order of the sound speed. And the value of the propagation velocity is at some factor, it's smaller than really Rayleigh speed itself, because we have some additional dissipation here. And this is precisely what one principle observes in nature. We can also look at the tip radius, how it behaves. So again, this is a driving force here. This is a tip radius expressed in some units. I will comment on this soon. First, we see the following. So here in this area, I have a magnification of this area here. First, if we increase the driving force, the tip radius goes down. This is exactly what we expected, because we saw this in the Greenfield instability. We can make the structure, by making the structure finer and finer, the propagation velocity can increase and increase. But then we have some turning point, and we have some blunting of the crack tip. And this finally leads to this termination of the velocity. What is important here, and I mean, this is important, but it also gives some limitations to our theory, is that the scale of this velocity, this Vr over d, which comes out of all equations, this is of atomic scale. And of course, we are doing here macroscopic theory, not taking into account atoms. Of course, this is let's say it's discussable whether this theory is really applicable here, but we believe that at least the scaling is correct, and it might give some correct ideas how to explain all this, but of course it cannot give quantitatively exact results, so they might differ by some factor. And of course it's also not correct here to have an isotropic theory if we really see, if we're really on the scale of atoms. But on the other hand, this is great, but because we are doing pure macroscopic theory, and what comes out is that the scale of the crack tip is of atomic units, which is exactly what we observe in nature. Right. Yeah. So I mean, let's also go back to this here. The velocity itself does not depend on the diffusion coefficient. So this is always fast. But how can the system achieve this? It does it by making the length scale smaller. So let's say if you have a small diffusion coefficient, then the length scale must also be very small. So it enters here into this solution here. And yeah, of course, if you use ordinary values of the diffusion coefficients, this expression sometimes can even be subatomic. But the point here is, which is very important also, that we have strong dissipation in the vicinity of the crack tip. And the crack can heat up really up to melting temperature. This is really seen in experiments. And this, of course, increases the diffusion coefficient almost exponentially. And then it becomes large, and we can reach some values which are bigger than atomic scale. So now we understand what's going on in the steady state cause. Now I can come back to this instability. We saw in our model that the velocity can go down if we increase the driving forces. Could be understood as a sign of instability, but this is really a model-dependent case. And also it's very important. I mean, we use the local model to analyze all this, but the Grignard instability, the secondary Grignard instability, which can disturb the shape of the crack, it appears only if we really take into account non-local effects. This is a very general feature of the Grignard instability, that it requires non-local effect, and of course it cannot be present in a local description here. But we can simply do our scaling analysis again. We can evaluate the local Grignard length in the vicinity of the crack tip. It behaves like R naught, where this is the tip radius, divided by delta. Delta is the driving force. And this has to fit into the tip radius. And of course, here one easily sees that they become comparable if delta exceeds some critical value, which is in this description, of course, of order unity. So we really expect this instability here. So let me come to the end of my talk. Summing up, we described theory which describes crack growth by surface diffusion using pure macroscopic theories, and it only consists of theory of elasticity including dynamical effects plus surface diffusion. What we observe if we do this kind of theory, that we really have some limitation of the velocity to values far below the relative speed. We have some blunting of the tip, which is seen also in experiments. We have a scale of velocity which is set by the Rayleigh speed, which is quite surprising because usually surface diffusion is slow, but the diffusion coefficient itself does not enter into the expression for the propagation velocity. We get some atomic radius, which contains, of course, then the diffusion coefficient, which is of atomic scale. And we have some instability, provided that some critical driving force delta is exceeded. And what we are currently doing is that we really try to solve this problem, really solve the elastic problem, and find everything self-consistently using a real description of all this. We do this by using phase field models, some eigenmode expansion techniques, and recently also by so-called boundary value integrals. Thank you very much for your attention.
That is instability at the end. So that's responsible for the saturation and fallout that you see, or you think that would lead
to the splitting? No, this leads to the tip splitting, because I mean this is an instability which occurs in the co-moving frame of reference of the tip, and it really leads to perturbation of the crack tip, and it can amplify in time and become stronger and stronger, and this can lead to the tip splitting instability.
And it has nothing to do with Yossi. I mean, Yossi, somehow the fact that the stresses are coming near that tip, as you can see in your local model,
there is no direct relevance.
You're right.
This is not seen direct.
You're right, and of course, see, it's very important that this angular distribution of stresses is also velocity dependent. If this wasn't the case, then all this wouldn't work, because then we again had no selection of the tip radius. It's very important that we have some dependence here. And of course, since we have, I mean, this Grinfield instability is also most pronounced in areas where the stresses are biggest, because this Grinfield instability is something like the E times alpha divided to P squared. Therefore, it will also appear in this region, sure. But it does not directly, it's not directly visible here.
There's another physical effect which other people, myself and Kessler and Levine and others who report on this, have brought up. It's giving another way to have the steady state velocity limited, which is in effect viscosity. The effect that your elastodynamics that you use is lossless, if I understand correctly. It's lossless. And if you have elastic waves in this material, they'll go through. But of course, for elastic waves of this wavelength, there is acoustic attenuation that's very substantial. And I made some estimates to publish. It said that in fact they're going to be rather substantial. That gives another scale. That gives in principle another scale for velocity. Mm-hmm. Have you thought about that at all? Can that
Well, what I know is that the usual expectation, the percentage of removing energy by sound wave is about 2% of the expectation. And secondly, if you discuss.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
The second, real steady state growth in the strict geometry, in terms of reflection of those waves and the principles, everything is taken into account just by knowing correct stress intensity. If you use correct stress intensity factor for strict geometry, it in some sense it takes into account all this effect. But I never thought that it can really give some let's say, diffusion, if you don't introduce diffusion at all, any real dissipation at all. I don't think that you have a chance to have that landscape. You cannot construct. The main idea is that if you look as a problem, and you will see, you will introduce all the fracture mechanics. You have in your disposal, apart from driving force, which is dimensional quantity, you have in your disposal all the sound fields, and you cannot construct landscape. The crucial thing here, it's my opinion, you have to have both, let's say, some dissipative coefficient like diffusion coefficient and sound velocity to construct both.
I agree with you, but the dissipation that we introduced was in the elasticity.
You mean, let's say, viscoelasticity?
Yeah.
Ah, okay, that's fine.
That's my point. I mean, I argue that, yes, indeed, as long wavelengths, viscoelastic effects in ordinary solids,
you know,
it's small, but we're talking about
near
the tip.
Yes, for sure. If you estimate dissipation due to viscoelasticity, for example, you will see that it's divergent at the tip. It's again local dissipation near the tip. And
I agree with you.
In some sense, you're perfectly right that since all this process zone is a mess, there are enormous amounts of things happening there. We simply try to introduce just the simplest model, just one dissipation process. Of course, it's conceivable that instead of substance diffusion, you introduce your viscoelastic dissipation rate. But still, you need mass transfer if your radius of curvature is finite. And this mechanism is nice, pure from theoretical point of view, not talking that if nature it should be like that. But it contains both mass and dissipation simultaneously, which I'm not very sure that pure dissipation. My feeling is that if you would do pure viscoelastic dissipation, you will not be able to have steady, or maybe I'm wrong, steady growth with finite radius of curvature, which require, it will be in some sense again infinitely sharp.
What?
Okay, I'm not sure.
I'm talking about lattice model.
Yeah. In lattice model, no problem. In lattice model, where you have plane scale at all, and you don't need a real mass transfer, it's perfectly okay.
Any further questions, comments?
So the saturation.
Yeah.
That's not seen in experiments. That's so strong. The saturation and the fallout.
Right, because the reason is, I think this is at least what we believe, that let me find this curve again. What we believe that we have, first of course we have this increase of velocity, that we have some, at least some sign of saturation, but all this, what happens here, will most likely we be screened by the instability, and then we get the strong fluctuations here because the steady state propagation here becomes unstable. This is just the steady state solution itself, but on top of it, we still have the secondary instability, which will remove all this here, and then we have some funny behavior here. This was just to understand that there is some saturation which must be below the threshold.
Okay.